Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Add retailers to the list of industries looking for a government handout. This one's got a twist, though. Today, the National Retail Federation asked President-elect Barack Obama for a series of tax-free shopping days early in the new year. Call it a desperate attempt to revive consumer spending on the heels of dismal holiday sales. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Paramount Pictures, presenting The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, starring Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett, directed by David Fincher, in theaters Christmas Day. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the 23rd of December. The economy, of course, is a big factor in those slow sales that have retailers in a panic. Potential shoppers are watching their retirement accounts shrink, and the housing market seems to get worse by the hour. Today we learned existing home sales fell by yet another record amount last month. But over the last week and a half or so, Mother Nature has had to take some of the blame. One of the worst hit areas is the Pacific Northwest, where an unusually heavy amount of snow brought shopping in Seattle and Portland to a standstill. Mitchell Hartman reports from the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting on a couple of stores trying to shovel out and survive.
It's 2 days before Christmas. There's a foot of snow on the ground. It's still impossible to find a place to park, and I'm going to look for stores that are open.
It's a morning ritual that we do to kind of announce to the street that business is open and we're here.
That's Katie Mueller opening up the New Age book and gift shop she manages. No bells rang on Sunday when the shop was closed due to snow, but yesterday when they reopened, store clerk Eamon Wright says shoppers were buying.
If they can get to one store and get as much shopping done as they can do there, they will. And so we've had big sales, not a lot of sales.
Love and Stuff Flowers.
Jody Iverson manages her family's flower shop. They didn't open to retail customers yesterday, and today they were opening late. Opening at all was a gamble.
For walk-in, it's kind of hit and miss. When there's little sun and the streets are clear, there's a flood of people. When it has a fresh snowfall, everybody stays inside. So paired with the economy, it's kind of been a downer.
I met Bob Sherb shoveling the small parking lot of his wine shop. He hasn't closed a single day during the latest storms. As a small business owner, he figures by keeping his doors open, he'll capture whatever shopping is left in this dismal holiday season.
We felt with the holidays coming on and the season already being pretty negative, we needed to stay open and make sure that our customers were served and that we were going to make it through the holidays.
And Sherb's suggestion for shoppers trying to make it through? A nice bottle of Madeira or port. In downtown Portland, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If neither of those options piques your taste buds, how about a steaming cup of joe? Well, unfortunately, the stale economy has ground Starbucks' stock price into little bits. Shares are off more than 50% from their frothy high of a year ago. The Espresso King recently said it would slow its attempt to be on every street corner on the planet. It's shutting down 600 stores. Now, Colombian coffee growers are thinking maybe it's time to take advantage. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Colombia is famous for its mountain-grown coffee, but coffee production there has been slashed nearly in half by foreign competition from places like Vietnam. Colombia's coffee growers are now in search of a better foothold in the U.S. The Growers Federation says it plans to buy a good chunk of Starbucks early next year.
This would be the first time an entire country would have made an effort like this.
That's Mark Inman, president of the Specialty Coffee Association of America. Starbucks right now sells coffee from around the world. By owning a chunk of the company, Inman says Colombian growers may get preferential access to American coffee addicts.
This is the next step in the evolution of specialty coffee. I think you'll see more of these moves happen as we move into the future.
University of Miami professor Bruce Bagley edited the book, The Future of Coffee in Colombia.
They believe that they have the money, they have the quality coffee that they could sell through Starbucks. They see it as a major investment opportunity for Colombian coffee over the next several decades.
Starbucks declined comment, but the company has resisted past efforts to influence what coffee varieties it markets to customers. Before this latest move, Colombia tried to compete head-on with Starbucks by opening stores named after its mustachioed spokesman. The effort fell flat. There are just 170 Juan Valdez stores worldwide, compared to Starbucks' 16,000. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
By the way, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Starbucks today joined the growing ranks of companies that will not guarantee a match for employee 401ks next year. Media reports today say Toyota's president will step down next year. The news comes a day after the Japanese automaker announced its first ever operating loss. So far, none of the big three CEOs in Detroit have agreed to do the same, despite steering their companies into the ditch known as a taxpayer bailout. It's supposed to help the automakers avoid bankruptcy, but we wondered how a bankruptcy would compare to the government rescue. So we asked bankruptcy expert Douglas Baird to join us from the University of Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what would the big three be forced to do if this were a normal bank-run restructuring versus a government bridge loan or bailout?
Well, what you would need to do, first of all, is you would have to figure out a way to get debtor-in-possession financing. Typically, you'd go to your most senior lenders and say, look, we'd either like you to provide us with a bankroll for the bankruptcy or you to give your blessing for us to go to somebody else. And you figure out, before you file for bankruptcy, how you're going to pay your bills and satisfy suppliers as they ship goods to you after you file for bankruptcy. They're actually going to get paid. That's the big number one problem you need to think about.
And that is not part of the government's current plan.
Well, actually, in the current plan, the government has this condition that says we have the right to be the debtor-in-possession lender if you file for bankruptcy. Now, it's a little bit obscure as a matter of existing law what it means for a lender to say they have that right, but the loan document, as prepared, the term sheet, does contemplate the government is going to play that kind of role. Now, the problem that a lot of people see with that is that it's one thing for a private lender to perform the role of the DIP financer. It's quite another thing for the government to do it.
Well, when you look at what the government is doing versus what a bankruptcy court or a bank would do, how credible are the government's demands from the big three in return for this loan?
Well, the big problem, of course, is the government is giving the money first and then asking them to make the changes, and that creates a problem. The second problem is that if you actually look at the biggest single issue these automobile companies have, it actually isn't the trade unions anymore. They've made lots of progress there. They're making more progress. The big problem is with these franchisees, and it's not obvious that outside of bankruptcy you can create the change in the dealer network that needs to happen, because there are a lot of state laws that basically make it impossible for you to get out of these dealer arrangements outside of bankruptcy. And it's not a walk in the park inside of bankruptcy either, I should add.
Is it possible to take a look at the situation now with kind of this Band-Aid approach by the government and say whether this could possibly work or whether bankruptcy is inevitable, at least for one or two of the companies?
If you look at the term sheet and look at the way this is structured, it's not obvious to me that there isn't some recognition that bankruptcy is a distinct possibility. And it may very well be what's happening here is that you're providing the financing not so much because you think it's going to work, but rather you think the financing will help you put these companies in a situation such that 3 months from now, a bankruptcy won't be as catastrophic.
Douglas Baird is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Detroit automakers have blamed some of their problems on retiree pension obligations. Today, President Bush signed a law that allows some companies to postpone increases to their pension contributions. The law also temporarily eliminates the mandatory 401k withdrawal for people who are over 70 and a half years old. But the reprieve is only for withdrawals in 2009. Another slow, non-jolly day on Wall Street. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Lower interest rates can be a good thing for the economy. They boost lending and spending, or at least that's the idea. But rock-bottom rates can have just the opposite effect on at least one group, those who provide free legal services to the poor. As interest rates drop, so do their funds. So finding a free lawyer is getting harder by the day. As Marketplace's Jeff Tyler tells us, the cutbacks couldn't come at a worse time.
We all know our rights from watching TV.
You have the right to the presence of an attorney. If you cannot afford one, one will be appointed before any questioning.
That's true if you're facing jail time. In civil cases, like foreclosures, evictions, unemployment claims, you have no right to a lawyer if you cannot afford one. This gap has been filled by legal aid groups, but the funding that pays for free legal help is fast disappearing. Don Saunders is with the National Legal Aid and Defender Association.
We've seen, in some states particularly, dramatic drops almost overnight.
Many states fund legal services in part by pooling tiny amounts of interest generated by escrow accounts. Those funds then collect interest themselves. In the past, they have been a stable source of income, but Steve Epler-Epstein with Connecticut Legal Services says that's changed.
In this peculiar economic downturn, business activity, particularly real estate transactions, have come to a halt at the same time that interest rates have plummeted.
That double whammy has eviscerated legal aid budgets across the country.
The revenues on this funding stream in Connecticut have dropped by 80%.
Massachusetts legal aid offices are churning away new clients. And in Texas, over the past couple years, funding has dropped from $28 million to $7 million. That means fewer lawyers to help people like the bishops. 62-year-old Pat Bishop lives in Austin, Texas, with her husband, a Coast Guard veteran.
My name is James Bishop.
James is disabled. He had a stroke and suffers from Alzheimer's. One day, out of the blue, the bishop's landlord stopped accepting their rent and told them to get out.
We had always paid our bills on time, and we had no problems. We didn't bother anybody.
Without free help from legal aid, Pat says,
I don't know what we would have done. I can't pay an attorney $300 an hour, we would have been out on the street.
As the recession deepens, fewer legal aid groups will be able to pay staff lawyers. Don Saunders says these cutbacks couldn't have come at a worse time. With workplace layoffs mounting, tensions tend to rise at home.
When economic stresses are put upon families, it's always been the case that levels of domestic violence are increased, so there will be a huge need for legal assistance for low-income people.
That includes the formerly middle class. There's a growing number of folks seeking legal aid who used to be able to afford a lawyer.
They are the new poor.
That's Randall Chapman with Texas Legal Services Center.
With predatory lending and the job layoffs that are now going on, we're seeing more and more demand. And frankly, those people are being denied legal help. There just are not adequate resources.
The legal services community hopes to get some financial assistance through state and federal stimulus packages, and bar associations are calling on lawyers to do more pro bono work. But with funding in a free fall and demand for legal aid climbing, fewer people will get their day in court. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
We've all witnessed a financial boom and one spectacular bust. It is the stuff of drama. But poetry? Katie Lederer is a poet who did indeed find inspiration in high finance. Lederer worked for 6 years as a hedge fund recruiter in New York. She recently left and now has a book of poems out. It's called The Heaven-Sent Leaf. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you come to write about high finance and money?
I studied poetry at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I was basically just doing my poet thing until I was about 30. And I just wanted security and health insurance, and I applied to work at a hedge fund. And while I was there, you know, obviously learned a lot about finance and ended up writing about it.
Your book is called The Heaven-Sent Leaf, and we had one of our producers read a bit from the title poem. Let's take a listen.
The speculation of contemporary life, the teeming green of utterance. To feel this clean, this dream éclat, there is in the heart the hard rendering profit, as if we were plucking the leaves from the trees. Let us think of the soft verdure of the spirit of this age, as now inside of us, swollen by spring rain. To imagine oneself as a river, to imagine oneself as a stretch of cool water pouring into a basin or brain. And if one knows one is not free, one crawls from the back of the head to the river and places one's pinky, oh, so cautiously in.
So the heaven-sent leaf, we're talking about money, right?
Yes, that comes from Goethe's Faust, actually, and it's basically a description of paper money.
The printing of money is certainly a big topic right now, as the Fed does a lot of it.
In the Goethe, actually what happens in this scene is an emperor is having economic problems, and Mephistopheles says, why don't you print these contracts based on the gold that's under the ground in your kingdom that hasn't yet been discovered? And in a way, this is an interesting version of a futures contract, an IOU, highly relevant, and obviously goes to show you, as I think people have realized, these bubbles have happened throughout history, and you know, you want to hope that people are going to learn from this one.
So how is it that you find money poetic?
You know, one of the answers to that question is that money is so unpoetic. It's kind of the opposite of poetry. And as opposites will do, it kind of jogged the other side of things for me. So being in that kind of very unpoetic space sort of inspired me more in a way than being, let's say, in a lush garden or, I don't know, a more cliche poetic space.
I detect a little bit of cynicism in some of your work here. Where's that coming from?
One of the things actually I studied in college was anthropology. So I couldn't help but bring that a little bit into the hedge fund environment, thinking this isn't my natural environment. Certainly I had some skepticism. I'd been trained all my life to be very suspicious of that kind of an environment and to feel that even if good people go into finance, you'll be corrupted, right? It's like Gollum in Lord of the Rings. You can be a great person and you get that ring of power and you become
a
slimy, slithery
yeah.
creature. You know, you have to kind of keep that ring or that money a little bit separate from yourself, or else you will be taken over by it.
Well, Katie Lederer, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for sharing your poetry. The book is The Heaven-Sent Leaf. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you'd like to hear a few more of Katie Lederer's poems or read them, visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, even if today's economy doesn't spell immediate disaster for you, the future can still be scary.
You know, I see my earning prospects going down over time rather than going up, and I know how hard it is to put together savings. So if it does go away or if something happens, then, you know, then it's worrisome.
But first, let's do the numbers. No need to put an elaborate spin on it. The stock market's lousy performance again today can be summed up in one word: worry. That's what pushed the Dow down by an even 100 points, 1.1% to close at 8,419. The Nasdaq dropped 10 points, 0.7%, and finished at 1521. The S&P 500 fell 9 points, nearly 1%, to finish at 862. Like a car stuck in a snowbank, it seems General Motors and Ford may be spinning their wheels when it comes to those government loans. Both automakers fell roughly 15%, as analysts warn that federal money they've received will only address their short-term needs. Bonds traded flat, leaving the 10-year T-note yielding about 2.17%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for November. U.S. markets wrap up trading early, just in time for some last-minute shopping. And on December 24, 1923, the first national Christmas tree was lit up on the White House grounds. President Calvin Coolidge hit a button, bringing 2,500 electric lights to life on a towering balsam fir from Vermont, his home state. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
The auto industry's dominated the news, not to mention our inbox, for the past few weeks. Last week, commentator Harley Shaken took us for a ride back to the time when Ford's profits soared after boosting employee wages. Listener Kayleen Larson of Brainerd, Minnesota, wishes all companies would take the same tactic today.
You can't have a self-sustaining marketplace if the employees can't afford to buy what it is they're producing. That kind of a system where all of the wealth floats on the top like cream and coffee, and the lower you go, the thinner it gets. That kind of system can't be sustained.
Commentator Virginia McConnell revved up another idea in the car debate, fuel efficiency. She said a gas tax could jumpstart demand for greener cars. But Tess Weaver of Cleveland, Ohio, wants to put the brakes on that idea. She says to encourage good behavior, the government should not encourage taxes.
They should encourage other incentives, for example, maybe not taxing stock investments or research and development investments, maybe offer tax breaks on environmentally friendly vehicles rather than taxing gasoline.
Since the holidays are here, we also spent some time looking at trends in giving. Religious charities might not be able to choose who they're hiring based on religious affiliation once President-elect Barack Obama takes office. Kirk Gulledge of Albuquerque, New Mexico, says a person's faith says a lot about what they can bring to a charity.
Faith-based organizations have always had the prerogative of being able to choose persons based upon being of like mind and spirit. If they could not, they just simply could not develop the kind of cohesive team and outreach that makes them so effective right now.
And finally, what you might call an editor's note. In our philanthropy series this month, we talked to Holden Karnofsky of the website GiveWell.net about how to make sure your contributions are being used most effectively. Many of you wrote to point out that earlier this year, GiveWell publicly reprimanded Karnofsky after he promoted the group inappropriately. You can learn more about it on our website, marketplace.org. While you're there, tell us what you think about the other things you hear on the broadcast. Click on the link that says Contact. This week, we're spending time with two American families as they prepare for the holidays. Yesterday, we heard from the Greenlees, a family of four struggling to make ends meet in Florida. Not everyone is in dire straits, of course. Many are still in their homes, able to put gifts under the tree. But it is certainly a year to reflect on how fortunate they are, which brings us to today's family. From New York, Sally Herships has that story.
Brian and Sarah Epstein live in a one-bedroom apartment in Manhattan's East Village. Sarah's 25. She's looking for a job in TV journalism. Brian is 40. He's an assistant professor at a university in Virginia.
The nice thing about being a professor is that it's a relatively stable job.
The Epsteins are in good financial shape. He made a lot of money in Silicon Valley a few years ago. She's been getting $12,000 a year from her grandparents since she was born. That's added up to a nice nest egg. So the Epsteins are comfortable, but they're still worried about the financial crisis. Sarah's family has been particularly affected.
My uncle just don't know where he's going to be.
Her uncle is a high-up lawyer at Merrill Lynch, so they're worried about his job. And then there's Brian's brother. He works at AIG. They're worried about his job, too.
And there was a time where every time he would call, you know, we would go like, you know, because we didn't know what was going to happen to him.
They're a bit unsure about what's going to happen to them, too. Brian isn't worried that he'll lose his job, but his salary isn't enough to live on. He and Sarah are depending on their savings.
And that's all the savings that I have. It's not that much. You know, I see my earning prospects going down over time rather than going up. And I know how hard it is to put together savings. So if it does go away or if something happens, then, you know, then it's worrisome.
They got a bad scare in September when the big investment bank started crashing. Sarah's phone rang at 7 a.m. It was her father with disconcerting news.
Merrill Lynch is bankrupt. You've lost all your money. And he hangs up the phone, you know, and I called Brian and I said, honey, did I lose my money?
It turned out Sarah's money was only managed by Merrill Lynch, not invested in the firm. So her funds were safe, but it taught them how fortunate they are to have a cash cushion, which many of their friends and coworkers don't.
It's really hard when you're in that pool of people to have more than they do, because there is this feeling that we're not going through the same thing that the country is going through.
As the state of the economy has gotten worse, it's made Brian and Sarah Epstein much more aware of how fortunate they are. Sarah says she doesn't think twice about picking up the check when she's out with friends and coworkers, and she's giving more to charity. They're also paying much more attention to their own finances. They don't talk about it, but they're taking a leaf out of Sarah's grandfather's book. He made a lot on New York City real estate. When the market tanked in the 70s, he saw the opportunity to buy buildings cheap.
And that's always kind of been on my mind as well. You know, can we take advantage of these times or not?
They've already made a start. They put some money into beaten-down financial shares, which they plan to hold for 10 years. And they're putting some more into their apartment. This holiday, they'll make latkes, light candles, and start decorating their home, themselves.
Tomorrow we're going to be painting the wall. Yeah, with Benjamin Moore paint, so we splurged on the paint.
A small luxury for a subdued season. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, bailouts are no longer confined to the banking and auto industries. Today, the Museum of Contemporary Art here in Los Angeles accepted billionaire Eli Broad's offer of at least $30 million to save the collection and its downtown home. The museum, known as MoCA, was considering a merger with the Los Angeles County Museum of Art to stave off financial collapse. Broad's offer includes a $15 million matching grant and another $15 million for exhibitions over the next 5 years. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 100 points, 1.1%. The Nasdaq fell 10 points, 0.7%. And the S&P 500 dropped 8 points, about 1%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on the program, why tooting your own horn in India could get you into trouble.
The first thing I noticed was tremendous amount of noise here, and that was intolerable. And I initiated a campaign called Quiet India Campaign, and our motto was, "On not okay, please."
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.